WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything you can want.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for July the 15th, 2018. Welcome to our weekly look at the world of politics and policy, from City Hall and the State House to the Capitol in Washington, D.C. Time to grab that Sunday paper, get that cup of coffee. We'll do our best to get your week off to a great, great start. A little muggy day out there, but it was pretty decent last week, and I had the opportunity Tuesday to go out to Guaranteed Rate Field to watch the White Sox play the St. Louis Cardinals. And I figure it was a free pass night for me, because being the Cubs fan that I am, I could actually root guilt-free for the White Sox. And I mean, and I do like the park. I go there frequently. I like baseball. But they had about 30,000 on Tuesday for the first of two games. I would say about 70% of them were Cardinal fans.
The Cardinals fans were just as intense about playing the White Sox as they would be with the Cubs.
There was a lot of red in the crowd. Let's put you that way.
Yeah, there was. Yeah, Andy, am I making it up?
No, but their money is green, so we'll take it.
Exactly. So, I'll admit the Cards shellacked the Sox that night. It was 14-2 was the final. But early in the game, Dexter Fowler comes to the plate.
Mm-hmm.
So, in sitting in front of me are an older couple, Cardinal fans. One, the elder gentleman's wearing a Stan Musial jersey, and apparently his wife wearing a jersey. It says grandma on it. Dexter Fowler comes to plate. I think it was the third inning. He's hitting 167. And how much is his contract that he's getting paid over there?
It's a lot. It's over $80 million. And he still has, I believe, 3 years after this year left on it.
Yeah. So he's hitting 167. And I yell out, "Hey, Dexter, you're on the wrong side of town." Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The elder gentleman in front of me turns around and says, "That was very rude."
Okay.
I'm looking at everybody around me. I'm not sure what was rude. So I said, "Sir, I apologize if you felt I was being rude. And in fact, I want to give you great respect for wearing Hall of Famer Stan Musial's jersey to the game tonight, and the fact that Illinois taxpayers helped pony up half the cost of that new bridge that crosses the river at St. Louis that's known as the Stan Musial Memorial Bridge for I-55/70.
You probably took him aback when you told him that.
I don't know what I took him, because about 20 minutes later, he and his wife got up and moved.
And they left?
Seats.
They moved?
Yes. But even as bizarre, was two seats over was a Sox fan in Sox gear. And I was not wearing Cubs gear. I wasn't, you know, I'm respecting the ballpark, you know. I had a Blackhawks hat on, okay? But there was a Sox fan. And she looks at me after they left, and she said, "You were being very rude."
Oh, so you got it twice?
Yes. Now, I don't get this, okay? Because I didn't say anything.
Yeah.
I wasn't being rude to them. I wasn't using vulgar language. I, for the life of me, it's as you know, this happened Tuesday. I'm still trying to figure it out. And, you know, it's Sox Park.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know, it's never been a real gentle place. And my only thought was, I hope these folks aren't St. Louis Blues fans. If they come to the United Center and think I was being rude, you're in for a whole new there.
Rudeness to the next level.
So, and of course, the ultimate payback came that later in that evening when Fowler hits a grand slam home run
right.
and pushes his batting average across the 173 mark, I believe. So the Sox get routed 14-2. Next night, they win 4-0. Some of my St. Louis fans were tweeting about how do the Cardinals lose to a 30-win ball club? I guess we got the answer last night when the Cardinal management decided to flush the clubhouse.
Yep.
And, I mean, Matheny, the manager, most of the coaches, I believe, also.
The hitting coach, who is a former Cub, John Mabry, and the assistant hitting coach, who is also a former Cub, Bill Miller.
So, in the end, it works out fine for me. I mean, because it looks like the Cardinals are really going to keep struggling this season.
Yeah, I'm still a little puzzled as to what was rude about saying that he's on the wrong side of town.
Said, Andy, I'm just perplexed by it.
Yeah, and you told me I probably wouldn't have an answer.
Right.
You're right. I don't have an answer.
I don't
get it.
It's baseball. It's baseball. And whatever. But anyway, it was a great evening to be at the ballpark. Great seats and beautiful night.
And not it was to mention the food.
And the food, yes. And it was good to see people at the ballpark too. You know, I mean, it really, really good. And thankfully that the Sox came back in that second game and win 4-0. Big game for the Cubs last night too.
Yeah, Avi Baez, it's his coming out party this year.
Isn't it, though?
I think everybody realized that he was a decent player during the World Series in 2016 and during the playoff run. But he's on a highlight reel every night, and it's not just because he's hitting home runs. It's because he's playing magnificent defense and basically stole a game the other night
from
the Padres, really. And he's just, to me right now, he's the most exciting player in baseball.
Well, and he's got 72 RBIs?
Yeah, he's gonna pass his career high.
Which was 75, right?
Set last year.
Yeah, I mean, that's at 72 at the break.
Yeah.
This is just fantastic, just fantastic. And and the Sox keep going up and down, you know?
Yeah, it's going to be that way.
Right. Know,
that's
we know that.
It's unfortunate that it's going to, you know, that it looks good when you beat the Cardinals, and it looks good when you beat the Royals in the first game, and things kind of came a little unglued yesterday against a Royals team that's even worse record-wise than the White Sox.
Which I hadn't realized how far the mighty had fallen when it comes to Kansas City.
Yeah, they've fallen, and it's actually there's two teams in baseball that have worse records, and the other one's Baltimore, and they're getting ready to unload everybody. So that'll be a that'll be a fire sale of sorts in Baltimore. But yeah, I mean it's one of those things where young players take two steps forward, then they take one step back and one step sideways, and then they turn themselves around and do the hokey pokey. You know, so it's unfortunate that it has to be like that. But I think Sox fans really have a great understanding as to what this is all about, what the end all be all is, because all you have to do is look at the Royals a few years ago.
Great.
They did this one time, and they ended up winning a World Series. You look at the Houston Astros last year, and again, rebuilds are difficult, and they're so hard to pinpoint whether or not they're going to be successful. You have to really have a lot of things go your way.
Yeah, it's a lot of moving parts.
Yeah, you have to hit on all your draft picks. You have to, you know, make smart trades at the deadline. And, you know, I think Rick Hahn and staff there at Guaranteed Rate Field have a pretty good grasp on what they're trying to do here, and they've been following through so far.
Yeah.
So you have to put your faith in them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And now we move into the All-Star break.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, you know, going back to the Cubs, I guess with Javi and Schwarber, that was their practice for the home run derby.
Yeah, 19th home run for Javi and 18th home run for Schwarber. Hap got in the picture there, too. It should be interesting to see the home run hitting contest. And there's a lot of people that will tell you that you don't want to see your players in that because it changes their swing for the second half. And it can kind of get into their head that all they're trying to do is hit home runs. But again, it's like batting practice. So I don't really know how that would affect the guy going forward. You know, maybe a little bit getting started again, getting the timing going. But I think everybody's got that problem because you're out for 4 days.
Right, exactly. And you know, with Javi, I think of him not as a home run hitter, despite
no,
his home runs. I just think of him as just a very aggressive hitter.
Yeah, and it's funny because he's playing in a park right now where I had a chance to talk to Tony Gwynn several times when I was there. And he told me that a line drive will play in any park, and a lot of times those line drives will get enough backspin and on them that they'll go out of the ballpark. And I really kind of think that that's the style of hitter that Javi Baez is, as you point out. Very aggressive, hard swing, never really leaving anything to chance. You kind of know his intention is to try to hit the ball as hard as he possibly can.
Yeah, not necessarily as a home run, though.
No.
And you know, how many times have we seen him, like, go down on a knee or, mm-hmm. you know, almost you worry that he's turned his ankle yeah. for the way that he's twisted in the batter's box.
Yeah. And apparently, before yesterday's game, he wasn't feeling well.
Right.
And they weren't even sure he was going to play.
Yeah, that was the report I saw this yeah. morning. And, I mean, I obviously couldn't stay up for the whole game, but when the Cubs took a 3-2 lead, I kind of felt like things are going to go into cruise control at that point. And very happy to see that as well. Well, Dave's here to keep us up on all the news. Andy has the latest sports. Producer Cassara's here to field your phone calls. We're at 312-981-7200. That's also our text number, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/TheSundaySpin, all one word. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin, one word. And engineer Bob is here to see if he can place a bet on the World Cup final around 10 o'clock this morning, France versus Croatia. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcasts at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Skyline studio overlooking the Chicago River on Wacker Drive. Ahead on the Sunday Spin, after we catch up with the news and sports at 7:30, we'll speak to Dorothy Brown. She's the Cook County Clerk of the Circuit Court, and she's also a candidate for mayor of Chicago. We'll talk to her about how she sees her campaign and a path for victory. After the 8 o'clock news and sports update, we'll be speaking to Zach Kuski. He's the political director of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union Local 881. We'll be talking about that Fair Work Week plan that's being considered in Chicago. And then at 8:30, after a final check of the news and sports, we'll speak to State Representative Christian Mitchell of Chicago. He's just been named the interim executive director of the Democratic Party of Illinois, and we'll talk to him about the new job and whether there's a new direction for the Democratic Party in Illinois. That's all up ahead on your Sunday Spin. But before we launch into our weekly spin through national politics, I want to take a little personal moment. You don't have a lot of friends in this job, in the business of this job. You have a lot of acquaintances. You have a lot of people that you know, but you don't have a lot of friends. It's not meant to be that way, except there are some special people. And I'm very happy to say that John McGovern was my friend. John was a special person. He passed away unexpectedly. It sounds cliche. He passed away suddenly Friday. He's 48 years old. I've known John for decades. He was a spokesman, a strategist for a myriad of Republican candidates across the ballot. And what made him, I think, special was that, you know, and even in this day and age, which politics is just winner-take-all kind of thing, I mean, politics was always somewhat of a blood sport, let's face it, but John knew that the game is transient. Just like the names and the faces of the politicians are, that the political mood can turn fickle, that political ideologies among the electorate can shift. And through it all, he knew, in the end, he still had to be himself. He had to be trustworthy, and basically be civil. And I think the thing that is most among those traits that is missed these days, as I've spoken repeatedly about, is that factor of civility. He, over the years, He worked from a spokesman from the state Republican Party to serving as its executive director. He worked for former U.S. Senator Peter Fitzgerald's campaign. Judy Bartow Pinka's run for governor. Advised U.S. House Speaker Dennis Hastert. He coordinated runs by Mark Kirk and Bob Dold for Congress on the North Shore, as well as Kirk's 2010 Senate victory, U.S. Senate victory. And in this kind of world of hyperbolic charges that everybody's corrupt if they don't agree with you, or that it's fake news if they don't like the facts as they're being reported, John kind of reflected that old school kind of arguing your case, being very fiercely loyal to whoever he was working for, and also fiercely loyal to the views that he held. And it was always an understanding that there is room for compromise, that this partisan divide is so deep, yet most people, I think, still believe that there is a great wide swath of people in the middle that don't align themselves to each sides of the parties that make the most noise and get the most attention, that that's where compromise comes from, and that compromise is not a selling out of principles, but compromise is a way to look at achieving a greater good. And throughout all of his political campaigns, throughout all of the things that he did, and a passionate Cubs fan as well, I should point out, it was always about looking at that greater good. And John leaves a wife, Wentworth, sons Caldwell and Watson, as well as his sister, Courtney, his mother, Karen. I'll be posting information and an obituary on the Chicago Tribune's website later today, but the funeral services are scheduled for Wednesday in Lake Forest. And just so you know, when I tweeted on social media about his passing, I got as many comments from people who were shocked, who were Democratic consultants and strategists who had worked against him, expressing their condolences, as there were a myriad of Republican colleagues across the map. John will be dearly missed, and as I said, he was a very, very good friend. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. What a week in national politics last week. And kind of capping off the explosive nature of the week were the fireworks that erupted during a congressional hearing when embattled FBI agent Peter Strzok was confronted by Texas Republican Louie Gohmert about Strzok's credibility and lying to his wife.
And I've talked to FBI agents around the country. You've embarrassed them, you've embarrassed yourself, and I can't help but wonder, when I see you looking there with a little smirk, how many times did you look so innocent into your wife's eye and lie to her about Lisa?
Mr. Chairman, this is outrageous.
The credibility of a witness
is always an issue. Mr. Chairman, this is intolerable harassment of the witness. What's wrong with that? You need your medication.
So Gohmert got upset when Strzok was offered time to respond. And here's the FBI agent's response, and Louie Gohmert in round two.
I have always told the truth. The fact that you would accuse me otherwise, the fact that you would question whether or not that was the sort of look I would engage with in a family member who I have acknowledged hurting, goes more to a discussion about your character and what you stand for and what is going inside you.
It's to your credibility.
So, just another day in hearings in Washington, D.C. West. Well, we're going to shift things local now. And joining me on the phone is Dorothy Brown, the clerk of the Circuit Court of Cook County and candidate for Chicago mayor. Clerk Brown, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Rick.
One of the questions I've been asking the myriad of candidates running for the office of mayor is basically just, first of all, where do you see in a multi candidate field, where do you see as your path to victory?
Well, Rick, you have to understand that I am a proven leader with a proven track record and of leading a major governmental organization for almost 18 years, first of all. And second of all, I have a proven vote-getter record. Right here in the city of Chicago in my last race, I received almost 800,000 votes. And there were only about 590,000, not even 600,000 people that even voted in the last mayoral election. And the current mayor only received about 330,000 votes. So a lot of people are already used to voting for me, but also I have an outreach to all of the communities within the city of Chicago. And because over the last, 18 years, I've been out there working with them, providing support, providing outreach to them, providing services to them. So I have a relationship, and I have and they already trust me. So I see that as my path to victory. People that already know me and trust me and have already voted for me. And so, and my record of accomplishments in my office.
But you have run previously in the past for different offices and not been successful.
I have done that. But this time is different. I don't think people really recognize who I really am. And what I'm doing now, I'm having listening tours. I've been to three communities already, letting them know what shaped me, what formed me into the person that I am, why I have this high integrity, why I am willing to fight for them, because I've had to dig deep and fight all of my life, and the kind of humble beginnings that I came from, and how hard I've had to work to get to where I am, and how my parents are poor and uneducated, but yet they sent all eight of their children to college, and how I worked in cotton fields and that sort of thing. And that's resonated with people because I'm a person that's like them, that worked hard, but yet was able to overcome and accomplish things. And that's the kind of commitment that I'm going to bring to the office of mayor of the city of Chicago. So I'm helping people to understand exactly who I am, and then also to help them to understand my ability to run the city.
We had another police-related shooting incident last night in South Shore. Obviously, issues of crime are very significant in this race for mayor. What is your approach in dealing with the issue of crime?
First of all, I want to say my condolences to the family of the gentleman that lost his life, and also to say that I issued a press release, asking for calm within our community, but yet making sure that we have a transparent investigation that the community is fully aware of, and that any videos that are available to be immediately released so everyone can see exactly what happened. What I want to do is look at exactly what the training of our officers should be. That particular incident demonstrates that we need to make sure that we follow the roadmap, really, that the Justice Department gave us when it talked about use of force, which is something that we have to investigate as it relates to last night. It talked about accountability of police officers, community policing, which is what we did, what was going on last night, of course, but what kind of training are police officers being given to do proper police community policing? We want to look at exactly how supervisors are being trained. I want to look at the structure of the police officers in general, how leadership and governance analyze the entire office and see exactly how should we be managing the police department. I don't want to be a micromanager Mayor, as it relates to the police department, I want to look at some of the best ways that police departments throughout the United States are managing these police departments and some of these police departments where crime is going down. We want to look at those and implement some of those processes here in the city of Chicago.
Do you feel that there is a lack of adequate training in dealing with the various communities in the city?
I absolutely do. I mean, that was something that was really highlighted within the Justice Department report. And I believe that, you know, implicit bias is one of the things that really needs to be focused on. One of the things, Rick, that I want to do, I want to have a criminal and social justice reform in the city of Chicago. See, I believe that there needs to be an exercise of criminal and social justice. In other words, fairness. And I want to have a complete criminal justice reform where you take into consideration the police department as well as the court system, all of the different public safety agencies. We have to all work together. We talk about disproportionate minority confinement, and that has a lot to do with proper training and how are the police officers, first of all, arresting people, but then also what's the implicit bias that may be occurring with the state attorney, other judiciary, even the clerks of courts in the courtroom and the public defenders. Because I have trained many of my clerks of court employees on implicit bias. So I want to have a look at the criminal justice system as a whole and then make sure that everyone is properly trained. And implicit bias, I think, is one of the primary things that we have to focus on within the city of Chicago and how we approach individuals. Do we approach them with the bias in the first place? And therefore, that's how we deal with them.
When you talk about criminal justice, too, there's a lot of talk, too, about the issue of reforming the bail system and reforming financial-based penalties that keep people basically behind bars for financial purposes rather than for any actual crimes being committed.
Yes, that's something that, you know, and I appreciate Chief Judge Evans and my fellow public safety agencies. We've done a lot in looking at that. We have been meeting over the last several years. And, you know, one of the things that I have recommended is using technology and getting information, doing these pretrial services, even at the police department, so by the time they get to the courtroom, that we have had an opportunity to get the information that's necessary to properly set bond. Sometimes you're just finding out the information that morning. You don't have time to verify whether or not they have employment, whether or not they have somewhere to go and stay. So I've actually recommended over the years that there should be some type of technology, even having individuals to put the information in on iPads and that sort of thing, and then have that information available to be assessed. So the bail reform is important. And then, however, you know, there has to be a balance between bail reform and individuals. If you put them out on the streets, if you give them opportunity to go home, but there needs to be some wraparound services. We went to Maryland and we went to D.C., and we looked and we saw, especially in D.C., that Congress had actually allocated a certain money for wraparound services. You don't just put individuals out there and not make sure that if they have a mental health issue, if they have any drug issue, that they're not being taken care of.
We're speaking with Dorothy Brown, the clerk of the Cook County Circuit Court and candidate for mayor of Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline Studio overlooking the Chicago River. Joining me on the phone, clerk of the Cook County Circuit Court and candidate for Chicago Mayor Dorothy Brown. Clerk Brown, obviously we have to talk about the issue of this ongoing federal probe involving you and your office. And this has been going on for 2 years. What is going on?
Rick, I'm not sure exactly what's going on with that. But one of the things that I wanted to also mention as relates to the criminal justice reform and reducing crime in the city is our educational system. And I think that that is the answer to, if we we're able to get our children properly educated, then our children will have alternatives to crime. You know, our school system is not educating our children. We need a high-quality education. People should have a magnet school level curriculum at every school. They shouldn't have to fight for a few schools with magnet schools. And we need to have clean and safe schools. And I want to just throw in there that we need to make sure that our children are not victims of this sexual assault that's going on. We cannot forget that sexual assault that's going on. They need to know that people are going to be fighting for that. And then our dirty schools, that's the primary thing. I have no idea what's going on with that. I respect the law enforcement, and they have to do what they do. But I have to do what I do, what I am doing for our children. I have a burden for them, a burden for this community, have a burden for making sure that there's fair and equitable economic development for all of Chicago, and that we stabilize the finances of our city.
Well, I mean, let's talk about schools for a moment, but I want to go back to the other. But obviously, a lot of talk about, should there be an elected school board in this city? Is there too much control of the schools in the mayor's hands?
Well, I do think that there should be an elected school board. The school board manages our most valuable resources. They're responsible for our children, and they need to be accountable to the people, just like my office is accountable to the people. A lot of people sometimes say it should be appointed. No, it should be accountable to the people, because right now we have almost 70% of our high school graduates that are not even college ready. It's been a long time since we had even extracurricular activities that our children could enjoy, to have alternatives to crime, like I was raised with having music and band and things of that nature in schools. And then pre-K. We need to have a funded pre-K. Pre-K has gone down since the current mayor took office. And how can, by the time children get to the first grade, they're already behind if they have not had pre-K. And it's just a shame. I minored in college, in law school. You know, I'm an attorney. I'm also a CPA, and I hold an MBA. So I have all of these this background to help manage the city. But I focused on school law when I was in law school, and an individualized education plan for special education was one of the things that I learned that was just basic, and that's something that they have not done. You know, the Illinois State Board of Education had to take over the schools, and so it's important that we have an elected school board and that the people can hold them accountable.
But some people suggest that with an elected school board, that likely would result in, critics of an elected school board say that would likely result in too much control by electing allies of the Chicago Teachers Union into spots on the school board and basically have them negotiate with each other.
Well, of course, I support the Chicago Teachers Union and all unions. My father actually, well, even though we were poor and uneducated, was able to be a member of a union. And people are people. Regardless of who's on that board, they would have to be accountable. There are rules, regulations, and laws that you have to follow in order to make sure that schools are managed properly, regardless of who is actually elected to that board. They're going to have rules and regulations that they have to follow. And the people, not just the Chicago Teachers Union, and it may actually be even better that we're able to, you know, because teachers need to have proper salaries. Their pensions need to be properly funded. They're the ones that are actually there day to day with our children.
I do want to go back about the federal probe. And how do you assure voters that, have the integrity and can conduct the office of mayor while this federal probe exists?
Well, Rick, you have to recognize that I put controls and protections in place before I even took that office. I knew that two things that people attempt to take you down with, and that are how jobs are meted out and how contracts are meted out. So for jobs, I put in place a objective way of selecting jobs, and along the way, I put in place a technology way. So the computers actually select people for the job. I don't. I lost a lot of friends because of that, because they thought I could just give their relatives and friends jobs. But I wanted to keep myself totally out of it. I don't even know who's been hired until I go into orientation and say, welcome to the clerk of the court. So I had nothing to do with giving anyone a job. You can look at my finances and tell that I didn't take anybody from anyone because I'm just like a regular everyday person managing from day to day. And from contract standpoint, I put in place independent experts, people from my office, the particular department. They're the ones that do the review of the various contracts, and they select who is the best qualified. And when they let me know who that is actually the individual or company that is sent over to the county board. So I put those protective measures in place, probably because I've been auditing. I was an auditor for 20-something years, and I understood then, and I understand now, the kind of controls that are necessary to make sure that things are done in fair and with the highest of integrity. And that's also how I was raised.
One last question topic here is the issue of city finances and pensions and the growing costs of taxes, property taxes, growing fees for residents of the city. How do you look at the city's financial structure, and how do you view dealing with issues like pensions?
Of course, Rick, that's my baby with the finances. And of course, the city's, I think last year, about $28 billion short of what's due the Colorado Future Pension Plan. So we need future pension payments. So we need to do a thorough analysis of the city's finances. I want to develop a long-term financial plan for the city. I want to do something similar to what I did as clerk of the court. I put in place an analysis committee slash task force to look at every fee that we're collecting, that we were collecting. I want to do that for the city, determine the level of that fee, whether or not it's at the proper level. When was the last time it was changed? Is it in line with the consumer price index? Is it in line with what the costs that are being incurred in purporting out the particular services? I want a citizens and accountability review committee to be in place to look at what we're saying and have them have input as to whether or not there's a need. They did it in Phoenix, Arizona, and Phoenix, Arizona, that committee actually said, recommended to the community what kind of financing that needs to be done. I want to specifically look at TIFs and determine whether or not those TIFs are being properly used. Do we need another structure? Should TIFs be eliminated, or should they be continued, but continued and utilized properly? Or should there be another format done? I want to look at other cities like New York and Denver when they use many bonds that are smaller in amount and actually shorter in term, that were used to have properly fund the fund some projects for those cities. So we have to look at various ways of determining exactly how to stabilize the finances of the city. That's going to be one of my strongest things. And I want to find ways to benefit the taxpayers. How can we benefit those taxpayers that are paying? And then also, how can we get those taxpayers that are not paying to pay so that we have the funds necessary to stabilize this government?
That's Dorothy Brown, candidate for Chicago mayor, clerk of the Cook County Circuit Court. Thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Thank you.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. As I said, such a busy week in the national political landscape. I mean, it's hard to believe that the week began with President Trump and him and Brett Kavanaugh as the Supreme Court Justice to replace Anthony Kennedy.
In keeping with President Reagan's legacy, I do not ask about a nominee's personal opinions. What matters is not a judge's political views, but whether they can set aside those views to do what the law and the Constitution require. I am pleased to say that I have found, without doubt, such a person. Tonight, it is my honor and privilege to announce that I will nominate Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court.
Now, for his part, Kavanaugh said that in every case, he would be keeping an open mind if he wins Senate confirmation against an onslaught of Democrats fearing a reversal of abortion rights under Roe v. Wade.
Do you consider Roe v. Wade to be an abomination? And do you consider yourself to be a judicial nominee, like the president said he was going to nominate people in the mold of Scalia and Thomas?
Senator, on the question of Roe v. Wade, if confirmed to the D.C. Circuit, I would follow Roe v. Wade faithfully and fully. That would be binding precedent of the court. It's been decided by the Supreme Court.
Ask you your own opinion.
And I'm saying if I were confirmed to the D.C. Circuit, Senator, I would follow it. It's been reaffirmed many times, including in Planned Parenthood.
I understand, but what is your opinion? You're not on the bench yet. You've talked about these issues in the past to other people, I'm sure.
The Supreme Court has held repeatedly, Senator, and I don't think it would be appropriate for me to give a personal view on that case.
Okay, that clip actually was when Kavanaugh was at his confirmation hearings for the D.C. Court of Appeals and was asked repeatedly about Chuck Schumer, his views on Roe v. Wade. Perhaps a little bit instructive, perhaps not. We'll wait and see. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Skyline studio is Zach Kutsky, political director, United Food and Commercial Workers Union Local 881. Zach, thanks for getting up with me this morning, and thanks for trekking to the Allstate Skyline studio.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
It's a beautiful view.
I know, yeah, gorgeous. Hazy morning coming in here, but this is, you know, why we live here in January.
Yeah, because you're stored up all the humidity from then.
Remember it when.
Well, I wanted to have you on because I actually a few weeks ago had Sam Toya from the Restaurant Association on. We were talking about the issue of Fair Work Week proposal and dealing with scheduling and those kinds of things in Chicago. And I was wondering if you could just start from the basic of, you know, what UFCW is looking at and what they'd like to see as far as an ordinance in Chicago.
Yeah. So the Fair Work Week ordinance really is kind of an outgrowth of the Working Families Task Force work that was set up and convened by the mayor in 2015 and 2016 that really focused at that point on passing the earned sick leave policy here. But if you look at the report that was put out from that, at the bottom of it, there's a little asterisk that says Work Week schedules was brought up in every single meeting that we had, both with employers and employees, but there just wasn't a general consensus. From that Working Families Task Force.
So that was a big asterisk about needs to be addressed.
Exactly, yeah. And especially from the workers and that came and testified, they had, you know, multiple hearings throughout the city during this. You know, everybody said, I absolutely want the sick leave benefit, but it doesn't do me a lot of good if I don't have a schedule and a job that I can really rely on to not only like put food on the table and a roof over my head, but just for the other job that I've got or for the schooling that I've got. So yes, you know, access to sick leave and a higher minimum wage obviously benefits a worker, but really the kind of the foundation of that and why we think this is such a supplemental, you know, and beneficial policy to both of those laws now is the access to hours, the access to a reliable, stable work schedule week to week for, you know, the almost 400,000 plus hourly and retail workers throughout the city.
So where is the stand now when it comes in as far as the council?
Yep. So we did a reintroduction of the ordinance at the end of June at the 27th council meeting, and we picked up 30 sponsors on the council there, and it was discharged from rules, which we all know, you know, is where good things go to die. Discharged from rules into Alderman Chairman Pat O'Connor's Workforce Development Committee.
So we've heard from some businesses, mm-hmm. including the Restaurant Association, about in certain professions, it's not that easy to come out with the type of scheduling and advanced requirements that you're looking for in this.
Yeah, I would be remiss if I didn't mention what actually the advanced what the ordinance wants to do. So the main chunk, you know, kind of the main core of the ordinance is 2 weeks advance notice in scheduling, right? so that people can plan for their job, for their family obligations, and for their, you know, other job, for schooling, for training programs, what have you. That's kind of the main chunk of it, that you, a worker would get their notice of what their schedule is 2 weeks in advance. They would also have the ability to write to request. It's incredible to hear from workers right now that they don't even have the ability to say, hey, like, I've got classes on Tuesday and Thursdays. I can't work. Well, that's what your schedule is. So, you know, good luck getting your hours this week. And they, if this law were to pass, they would have the ability to say, I can't work Tuesday and Thursday to their employer. You've got to figure out where I can work otherwise, so long as I'm an employee here, right? So the ability to request and to, you know, really kind of build your own schedule on that too, it levels the playing field within that. It also gives access to hours for existing employees. So if you're a company, if you're a business that has additional work coming down the pike, if you're just, you know, doing pretty well and you need, you know, some extra hands, this gets at the issue of underemployment. A lot of people have jobs right now, but they have multiple jobs, or they're only getting 20 hours when they would really love 40 hours a week. So the law says, or the ordinance says, before you would hire somebody new, offer those hours, that opportunity to existing employees first. And so I think that's kind of a revolutionary approach to this.
Now, in that case, are you talking about people that would not, it's not be entitled to necessarily overtime?
No. And that is something that, you know, I think the employers who are going to have a seat at the table in negotiating this need to kind of figure out what works best in that regard, right? We even have obviously very supportive employers. Honey Butter Fried Chicken is a favorite restaurant of mine. And they're a high road employer over on Elston there. And they said, this is stuff that we already do. But we would be concerned that, you know, we're now starting to schedule people, you know, into overtimes on that. The vast majority, though, of these hourly workers don't bump up anywhere near 40 hours, right? So, I mean, we're talking moving somebody from 15 or 20 hours a week to maybe 25 or 30 hours a week. And that, you know, I think, again, really starts to get at the issue. When we're looking at increased employment, you know, the mayor keeps talking about how we have, you know, record low employment within the city. Some economists are talking about, you know, peak employment on this end. Obviously, that's not equal in all neighborhoods across the city. But when you talk to workers, when you survey workers, even when the Federal Reserve did their snapshot of the 2017 economy, they said that access to more hours for those already in the workforce is something that, you know, absolutely can be done and would, frankly, strengthen the overall economy.
Well, and because I do think there are, you know, it's been proven that underemployment is kind of, it doesn't get the attention
right
in this economic climate.
Yeah, it's a much larger chunk of the, you know, workforce, really. We've, you know, especially post-recession, we've kind of, you know, had an acceleration towards the gig-based to the temp worker type
of job. Well, and again, as part of that continuing evolution into a service-based economy.
Right, right. Which is, again, I think the strength of this ordinance. Where the industries that are in Chicago, the chunks of the economy in Chicago that are growing the fastest, our food service, retail, hospitality, you know, I mean, just service-based work on that end. And those are the portions, those are the industries that have the most unstable, you know, schedules, the most fluctuating. You know, you go from 30 hours 1 week down to 10 the next, right? And so that just throws workers' lives and their families' lives into chaos.
But on the contrary, that's those employers are saying, because those jobs and the require a lot of they require a lot of flexibility,
yeah,
because of, you know, what's seasonal, tourism, you know, those kinds of things, and that they need the flexibility. That seems to be the butting of heads here.
Yeah, you know, I mean, so there's a study that was done and released earlier this year with the University of Chicago in conjunction with The Gap, the clothing retailer. Susan Lambert's a professor down there. And in retail, right? And we're hearing brick-and-mortar retailers, you know, they're under increasing pressure from the Amazons of the world and everything. And I don't disagree with that, but they did a study where it was a control group. They took a chunk of stores in Chicago and a chunk of stores in California, and they did control groups where some of those stores, the ones in Chicago, did away with on-call, did away with or instituted advance notice scheduling, set up an app where you can get a text message and say, hey, there's more hours available, or so-and-so called out sick. If you want to pick up extra hours of that shift, you can do it via your phone. You schedule yourself. You can, trade shifts with another worker. And then a bunch of stores that didn't do that. And they controlled for the same type of foot traffic, same type of sales promotions, right? Just general, right. Same type of sales profile on that. And at the end of the year, those stores that instituted the scheduling changes were 7% more profitable and 5% boost in worker productivity. And that's a pretty good result for a fairly modest change in overall, approach from the company's front end. And I bring that up to say, people would say, especially in retail, there is massive fluctuation, right? If it's, bad weather out, you're probably going to take a dip in sales. And what Susan was able to show in this, again, in full partnership with the Gap, is the variances on scheduling, not so much the need of labor on that stays fairly consistent. There's ebbs and flows in it, but it's nowhere near as volatile as somebody that goes again from 30 hours working in a store down to 10 the next week. That's the volatility. That's the flexibility. And I'm putting that in air quotes. That's entirely imposed onto the worker, even though the labor needed to run a business, to open up that store, is actually fairly consistent. And so my challenge to industry on this, and Sam and I have talked about this multiple times, is show me where the massive variation in fluctuation in work is actually there. I don't deny, I worked landscaping, I worked, at a pizza joint when I was, a teenager. I get it. But that right now, that variance, that instability, that flexibility is entirely borne out and imposed by the worker. And what that does is it just throws their lives into chaos.
We're speaking with Zach Kutsky, political director of UFCW Local 881. I'm Rick Pearson. This is your Sunday Spin. Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline Studio on Wacker Drive overlooking the Chicago River. Joining me here in studio this morning, Zach Kutsky, political director for the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 881. We're talking about the proposed Fair Work Week in Chicago ordinance, the ordinance that would require employers to provide advanced scheduling of workers. Frankly, before the break, just the mere concept of that control group with the Gap and the concept of being able to schedule over an app is just, how the world has changed. But also, that is taking advantage of technology to kind of further what you're seeking.
Well, and that is our point, too. I mean, those technologies, those apps are already in the workplace. I mean, I represent a union and work for a union 35,000 strong in food and retail, right? And we've been dealing for decades now with, fairly sophisticated software systems, algorithms, right, that help the management side.
Move the product.
Move the product, but also deal with scheduling. Right. They know to a T how many people are going to walk into a Mariano's, on a Saturday, from 4 to 8. And so they're going to schedule appropriately. And that is throughout our economy. And unfortunately, what those software systems, what those algorithms have been done is it doesn't take into account the individual, right? It's just, this kind of...
It's the universe of employee need.
Need, yeah. And so we argued that those forces could be used for good too, right? You can use that sophisticated approach to knowing your work needs and your labor needs for good. And you can give people 2 weeks advance notice because you have a decade's worth of data to tell you on any given Sunday how many people are going to be coming into your restaurant. Your point of sale, can spit out a lot of good stuff that you could use that then to make a better informed decision to work with your employees to give them the stability and the predictability that we think every worker, deserves.
Now, you mentioned you've polled on this topic. What did your poll find?
Overwhelming support. I mean, Chicago is overwhelmingly in support of this. This was a poll that was done the first week of May, live dial, 500 sample survey, bilingual, and 79% of respondents in our poll, which are just registered voters, said that this is something that they would get on board with. 49% strongly supported it. And even more telling, in African American and in Latino respondents, the support of it was north of 80. I'm talking 84%, 86%. And of those respondents, majorities both were in strong support of this. And that makes sense because, again, when we're looking at who this, within the industry, within the economy, this ordinance would most focus on, is in food, retail, service sector, hospitality, and those are
and also in the underemployed segment of the economy.
Yeah.
Too.
So when folks, you know, are dealing with this the most, they have an understanding of the chaos that it throws their lives into. They're obviously going to be in really strong support of it. And, you know, again, this is something that it's not just hourly workers. These were salaried workers, but hourly workers, especially 85% of them said that they would absolutely, you know, love to have this. And our survey isn't alone in that. When, again, pointing to the Federal Reserve, they do this annual snapshot of the American economy. For the first time in 2017, they mentioned the instability in scheduling as a weakness in the overall economy, that it's driving down wages, it's, you know, forcing people to have two or three, you know, kind of gig-based jobs that still doesn't allow them to support their family and support their community and themselves. And so within that, they referenced a couple studies, but one of them most, you know, interestingly said, if you had the opportunity to have a job that had more stable and reliable hours that you could count on, but maybe paid a little bit less, or if you had a job that paid a little bit more, but you had no guarantee of work, which would you do? And overwhelmingly, respondents in that said, I would take the lesser paid, but more stable job, just because people have lives, right? And we always, you know, argue with UFCW that our contracts within our stores, within our union, provide dignity. Not only there is an equal voice with management, but dignity outside of your life. You're getting better wages and benefits so that you can live a good, fulfilling life. And, you know, we just argue that the dignity of knowing day to day what you're doing, if you can be there for your kid to go to their parent-teacher conference, if you need to care for an elder, the stress that that takes on you not knowing that is pretty, you know, debilitating.
So what's the future of this ordinance? You said you've got 30 sponsors. I mean, obviously, that's enough to pass.
We look forward to hearings in the Workforce Development Committee. We talked to Chairman O'Connor, and I believe that there's going to be some convening of both proponents and opponents and from the industry side to discuss, you know, what would...
So some further negotiations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do want to say that, you know, the ordinance that was reintroduced in June is already a compromise, I believe, from the proponents' end. This does not affect companies of 50 and under, right? So if you're a, you know, mom and pop... let's say we'll take the Billy Goat. If they've got, you know, 50 or less employees, this doesn't affect them. If you are a railroad worker, if you are a sister agency for the city at the CHA or the Park District, I know Sam mentioned, you know, what does this do for youth employment with that? It doesn't affect that. This is really just trying to focus in on the large scale employers that have these sophisticated scheduling processes and programs already in place to encourage them to use it for good, to provide stability to their workers.
As you say, for the most part, these employers already have these systems.
Yeah, absolutely. And I should say, too, that there are, again, the Gap is a good example. That's a major, you know, employer within Chicago and nationwide. They've already instituted a lot of this. Starbucks does month-out scheduling, right? And they have the ability, you know, they've very proudly touted, saying this is actually provided for a more stable workforce within this. And you know, for the employer on that end. And the other thing that I would say is, you know, this is Chicago, right? This is a labor town. This is 500,000 union members live in the city of Chicago. You know, triple that with when you're including their household. It understands the chaos, but also the dignity that a more stable life can provide for you and your family. And that starts with the schedule. And I always think back, you know, in the 1860s, Chicago started looking at 8-hour work weeks, right? I mean, this was, or 8-hour work days. This is not a revolutionary approach to dealing with a worker's life and their, you know, ability to plan for themselves. And there's always that famous cartoon that says, you know, 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for do what you will. And so we just want to make sure that workers have that ability to rest, work, productive, you know, schedules, and then certainly provide for themselves and their family.
Zach Kutsky from the United Food and Commercial Workers Union Local 881, the UFCW Political Director. Thank you so much for joining
for
me this morning.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Skyline Studio on this sunny but a little muggy Sunday morning, but it's a beautiful day up here in the 18th floor studios, and the river and the skyline looks just great. Well, President on a foreign trip,
First, he went to NATO, went to the United Kingdom, on his way to Helsinki to meet with Vladimir Putin. And, of course, we have the president once again saying that he believes the Russian investigation is a witch hunt. That, he said, while the U.S. Justice Department announces the indictments of 12 Russian operatives, former GRU people, for hacking into Democratic websites, hacking into State Board of Election websites, including Illinois. That's the witch hunt. The president, apparently this morning, after his round of golf at his resort in Turnberry, in Scotland, was asked by reporters if he would ask Vladimir Putin to extradite those 12 Russians who were indicted. And the president's response was that he hadn't thought of that. Anyway, while the president was in the NATO summit in Brussels, he lashed out to NATO about Germany paying Russia to get energy.
It's very sad when Germany makes a massive oil and gas deal with Russia, where you're supposed to be guarding against Russia, and Germany goes out and pays billions and billions of dollars a year to Russia. So we're protecting Germany, we're protecting France, we're protecting all of these countries, and then numerous of the countries go out and make a pipeline deal with Russia, where they're paying billions of dollars into the coffers of Russia. So we're supposed to protect you against Russia, but they're paying billions of dollars to Russia, and I think that's very inappropriate. And the former chancellor of Germany is the head of the pipeline company that's supplying the gas. Ultimately, Germany will have almost 70% of their country controlled by Russia with natural gas. So you tell me, is that appropriate? I mean, I've been complaining about this from the time I got in. It should have never been allowed to have happened. But Germany is totally controlled by Russia.
So actually, the energy figure is believed to be more like 9%, not 70%. But you have that going on with our European allies and the United States. And back in Washington, Republicans are stepping up concerns about President Trump over a trade war, especially after another round of tariffs were slapped on China, expecting counter tariffs to come back on our goods. Republicans in big ag states want to know what the end game is. Here's Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley on Fox News.
I'm very, very nervous about it, and my constituents are very, very nervous about it. And it doesn't just affect the 5% of the people in Iowa that operate farms. It ripples through the whole economy. I am a free trader. I do want the president to level the playing field with countries that have more barriers to trade than we do. But the uncertainty of it is very bad, and we do know this, that if the president, the negotiator is, brings these negotiations to the brink, and if he doesn't go over the brink, we know that it's going to be better for the United States. But if he does go over the brink, it's going to be catastrophic, and with the price of soybeans and corn falling the way it has, it's already been catastrophic if you want to sell your beans and corns today. If you wait a while, maybe you can do better, or if you sold them 2 months ago, you'd do better. But this has had a very detrimental impact on current markets.
That's Republican Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley. Well, joining me now on the phone is Christian Mischel. He's state representative from Chicago. He's also the newly named interim executive director of the Democratic Party of Illinois. Representative, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Hey, Rick, thanks for having me. It's an honor to do the spin.
Well, I'm sorry I did not get a chance to personally see you out in Rosemont on Friday, where you were leading the demonstration against the appearance of Vice President Mike Pence, joined by Governor Bruce Rauner. But I'm curious, does that signal a new kind of activism for the Democratic Party of Illinois?
Look, so again, thank you for having me on. Thank you to your listeners. Look, the reason why I sort of want to step up in this role is that I think this is the most important election of our lifetime. I think people say that often, but these times really are unprecedented. You saw last week at that event, Governor Rauner fully wrapped his arms around the Trump-Pence administration. And that is an administration that has been openly racist, openly misogynistic, that has waged war on a woman's right to choose. It has waged war on unions and working people. And I think that the message we wanted to send by being out there in opposition was that Democrats believe Illinois deserves better than this. We believe that we ought to respect the rights of workers to organize, that we ought to protect a woman's right to choose. We believe in the dignity and the rights of people of color. We believe that immigration, you know, where you've got an administration that's ripping kids away from their parents at the border that the governor is implicitly supporting by not speaking out more forcefully, we believe that immigration makes our state and our country great. And so my goal is going to be to make sure that we take that message to every corner of the state, that we win races up and down the ballot. And I'm going to be a voice, along with the unions and the activist groups and the folks who are out there organizing, to make sure that that happens, that we bring people out to win in November. And so what you saw at that demonstration was the beginning of making sure that we are as active as possible in organizing the energy out there to push back on what Governor Rauner's done to our state, what Donald Trump is doing to our country.
Well, this is kind of a significant change as far as what the Democratic Party of Illinois has been, which has been kind of more of a, I'd almost say, kind of a bureaucratic organization rather than an activist organization. That's not to speak about the members of the Democratic Party, but just the Democratic Party of Illinois as kind of an institution.
Yeah, and look, I think that this is an opportunity for us to be more vocal. You know, I sort of, even as a state representative and as a political actor myself, I've always believed that being out forcefully, pushing back on.
I was going to say, you've never been shy, that's for sure.
That's correct. So, that's my particular style. And I think that, to me, my hope is that my elevation of this role talks about the changing face of the Democratic Party. It's becoming younger. It's becoming more tech savvy. It's becoming people of color are becoming more engaged. And so I hope that I'm a foot in the door for that sort of changing guard and style of leadership. That said, ultimately, Rick, my goal is to continue doing something that DPI has been successful at for years, which is to win races. And I bring significant campaign experience in doing that. But what we're also going to do now is focus not just on the legislature, but also focus on winning those races up and down the ballot. And I believe that being out, responding quickly when Republicans say things that are against our values, that are offensive to the people of this state, is an incredibly important part of that.
How does the J.B. Pritzker candidacy fit into that? Obviously, with his financial resources, he's able to not only help fund, largely self-fund his own campaign, but also devote resources for kind of building up the Democratic Party almost in a way that we saw with Bruce Rauner using his wealth to basically build up a Republican Party.
Well, I think that JB's resources are obviously helpful, but what JB has said from the beginning is that his goal is to make sure that Democrats win up and down the ticket and that they have the resources to do so. You'll note that when I started executive director, one of the things that was my first announcement in conjunction with the JB for Governor campaign was this $1 million voter registration drive that we're going to do in conjunction. And that is the goal of capitalizing on this energy that we see around the state to say you've got people who haven't voted in a while or maybe have never voted who are horrified at the 800-day budget impasse that Governor Rauner imposed on the state or horrified about the mismanagement that led to deaths at Quincy or the out-migration of 50,000 students or who are looking at the national level and saying, you know, Trump does not represent the values that we represent here in Illinois. Those are folks who are energized and who can be brought in. And I think that the party and the JB campaign are looking at this opportunity and saying, let's capitalize on this because it can allow us to build the kind of majorities in the House, in the Senate, in Congress to protect the rights that we already have and to expand the ability of the state to do more good for people and to stand up for workers, for people of color, et cetera.
So when you look at, those, for example, this voter registration drive, this is something beyond the normal, you know, let's do something at a college campus at the start of the school year or that kind of thing. This is a more kind of a targeted based effort.
I think it's correct. And so you're seeing us look at places where we think we can have pickups in the House and Senate here in Illinois. You are seeing we have some incredible candidates who are running for Congress around the state. You've got Brennan Kelly down in the 12th District. You've got Betsy Londegren down in the 13th. You've got Sean Cassidy running against Peter Roskam, who, by the way, didn't even have the guts to show up to a rally and fundraiser that Vice President Pence was here holding in his honor because he's trying to run away from his extreme record that we're now highlighting. And so the goal is to make sure that we add additional voters to the rolls who are going to come out and are going to vote and who are appalled by what they're seeing right now, but also making sure that we are delivering the message up and down the ballot about how extreme right-wing Republicans have been hurtful to our state and do not actually represent the values of their communities.
We're talking to Democratic State Representative Christian Mitchell from Chicago. He's the interim executive director of the Democratic Party of Illinois. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson from the Chicago Tribune. We're talking to Democratic State Representative Christian Mitchell from Chicago, who is the new executive director of the Democratic Party of Illinois. Representative, when you talk about, you know, this million-dollar effort for voter registration, as we all know, it's one thing to get people to sign up. It's another one to actually get them to turn out. So are we to expect that there's going to be kind of a similar type of cash infusion for get-out-the-vote efforts?
Yeah, look, I think so. I think you've got the combined efforts of the JV campaign. You've got the work that we're going to do at DPI. You've got the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which is obviously focused on these congressional efforts. We think this is a tremendous opportunity. It's going to be a good year for Democrats. As you know, Rick, the year when a president is in power, generally the midterm election is not so great for his party. That's in a normal situation. When you don't have a president whose polling has been underwater since the day he got into office, who has done so much to offend American values, and when you don't have a sort of a unique local situation like we do in Illinois, again, Bruce Rauner's budget impasse at 800 days is unprecedented. 50,000 college students leaving the state is unprecedented. An open war on unions and working people is unprecedented. And I think that you're going to see tremendous energy of people wanting to come out to vote. That's in addition to the people that we're getting on the rolls. And we're going to have a very focused effort on digital, on television, on mail, to make sure that all of those folks have the information that they need to know what their choice is and have every opportunity to come out and vote. We're going to push them to do so.
Well, here again, in talking about digital and those kinds of things, again, this seems to be a leap forward of moving the Democratic Party operations into the 21st century.
Yeah, look, I think some of that stuff has sort of began before I got here. I think that my goal is going to make sure that we continue to push that ball down the field and use all the tools of modern campaigning to make sure that we elect candidates up and down the ballot. That's my focus.
In your selection, this was done by a panel of 18 Democratic State Central Committee women. One from each of the state's congressional districts, as well as some other women. And it was kind of, in some respects, viewed that in the aftermath of the Me Too movement, the problems that surfaced with your predecessor, Tim Mapes, that led to his departure, that this would be a spot that would go to a woman.
Yeah, look, I think two things. One, I think that that the Democratic Party's face is changing. I alluded to this early, and part of it is a party where we are seeing and where we need more women in leadership. Part of it also is that we have more people of color getting involved in the party, and certainly as the first African-American executive director, I think that I represent that sort of change. What I would also say is that the committee search isn't open. I'm executive director of the party through the election until a new director is found. And I think that my wealth of campaign experience, having worked on the Obama campaign in 2012, having worked multiple statewide, including for Senator Duckworth and for Lisa Madigan, having done my own races and a city council race, gives us someone in myself who can come in, make sure that we are doing all we need to do to turn out voters, persuade them between now and the election, while giving the State Central Committee time to continue a national search and to find a sort of a permanent executive director. And so, you know, I'm in this role now. I will not be in this role in the very, very long term. My goal is to get us through the elections. And I'm quite confident that the committee's next selection will also reflect the changing demographics of the Democratic Party.
speaking of those changing demographics, and we, I think, you know, one of the reasons that we're looking at some of these targeted congressional races, particularly up here, is the fact of when you look at, for example, the collar counties, and in the presidential, you had every collar county, traditionally Republican collar counties, every collar county went for Hillary Clinton, except for one in McHenry County. But I'm also, I'm curious, though, about downstate demographics. And it seems like, you know, granted, you go where the votes are, but nevertheless, when you look at congressional races held, or congressional seats held by Republicans, like the 12th and the 13th in central and south, southwestern Illinois, when you look at those, I mean, those are some pretty red areas, and those are areas that at one time used to be represented by, I would say, socially conservative Democrats. And when you look at the hotspot map, they're pretty red. How do you turn those demographics around?
I think candidates and campaigns matter, right? So when you look at the 12th congressional seat, for example, you've got Brennan Kelly, a native Southern Illinoisan, who's an incredibly smart guy, been a great state's attorney, who is someone whose campaign platform reflects the district, who's working extremely hard, who's raising the money. I think that he's got a really good shot. I think you look downstate, down in Bunker Hill, for example, we've got Andy Menares in the state senate, who was the champion of changing the education funding formula, which put more money in downstate communities and poor rural school districts, but also helped districts like mine across the state. When you look at candidates like that, who have the sort of history of leadership, who are reflective of the values of their district, I'm not willing to cede downstate to the Republicans, especially, by the way, when I heard in the sort of audio segment before I came on, you had a discussion with, or there was Chuck Grassley talking about the impact of tariffs. Well, we got a lot of corn, a lot of soybeans here in the state of Illinois, and when Bruce Rauner is letting Donald Trump get away with this trade war that he's declared for the sake of his ego, that's hurting downstate communities, and it's another opportunity to talk to downstate voters about how the Democratic Party has a vision for the whole state of Illinois that uplifts workers, that protects the rights of folks to organize. I think this is an incredible opportunity in this year to sort of get a foothold back in those communities.
Is it all about Trump?
I think a lot of it's about Trump, but I think there's a lot of, again, about Bruce Rauner. I mean, this is, again, an unprecedented circumstance over the last 4 years. What happened to our bond rating, 800 days without a budget, the sort of seizure and, in some cases, closure of our child care system, an entire generation of young Illinoisans who would be going to college here, creating companies here, living here, paying taxes here, leaving the state, is in a sort of unprecedented local crisis that people are holding the governor accountable for. And that's before you get, again, to the fatal mismanagement where that led to deaths of veterans at the Quincy Veterans Home. There is a lot locally to motivate people for a change in the governor's mansion based on what they've seen over the past 4 years.
As you mentioned, you're in this job till through the November election. But I am curious, though, is the Democratic Party itself, in your view, in a more national level, but also at the micro level, kind of at a crossroads, just as we, you know, keep seeing the divides of kind of establishment Democrats versus the more progressive insurgent Democrats? Is the party at a crossroads in your view?
I think the Democratic Party has always been a big tent party, and I think that what you see reflected for us is genuine policy debates about the best way to move the state, the country, our local cities forward. But overall, you've got sort of a through line that runs through progressives, that runs through the Ocasio-Cortez win in New York, that runs through sort of mainline centrist Democrats, which is there are certain things that we believe in, and I noted them on this program. A woman's right to choose, right of workers to organize, making sure that our communities are open and vibrant and safe for immigrants who want to be here and want to make a better way for themselves and for their families. I think the Democratic Party is stronger than ever. I think that the fights that we're having will only make us stronger and better, and that they are genuine policy fights. They are not sort of the fights you see on the Republican side of the aisle about how much are we going to cozy up to the darker elements of our society, those who sort of believe in white nationalism, those who are xenophobic. the debates we're having on the Democratic side really are about substantive policy issues that we have disagreements on, but all sort of agree on the baseline of security, safety, prosperity for Americans.
That's Christian Mitchell. He's the interim executive director of the Democratic Party of Illinois, state representative from Chicago. Representative, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me. I'd love to come back.